Hello, everybody. This is the Right Dishonourable podcast. My name is Jazza.
My name is Jimmy.
And we're joined today. I don't know why I'm including you as a guest because you're an actual contributor. Hello, John. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you.
I'm quite worried that our voices are going to be quite similar.
No, so John has a slight more nasal quality to you. So, I've had to sit with your voice for like 45 minutes, so I'm very aware.
I mean, as does everybody else who is listening to this, I'm assuming, who listened to that podcast, had to go through John's voice. Aside from insulting John,
What you're going to be thinking now is that guy really does have a nasal voice.
Aside from insulting John, on the Right Dishonourable podcast, we talk about politics, social issues, and
a third thing.
And what the other things? I'm losing it. So this week, we are going to be touching on three topics, as we always do, and lasting no more than 45 minutes. First of all, we are going to touch on breaking news that only came out like an hour ago
recording probably 2 days ago.
The Conservative Party have announced their shortlist for London Mayor. Zach Goldsmith is on that list, including three people that we've never heard of. But a key thing is that there are two very high-profile candidates who have not been included on the Conservative shortlist, who are Sol Campbell and Ivan Masso. Secondly, we're going to be talking about what, John?
What are we talking about, secondly?
Donald Trump. Oh, my God.
Donald Trump. We're talking about the fact that he, despite saying some really incredibly controversial things, he is now the leader in the candidate race for the Republicans.
Well done, you've now introduced a topic on the Right Dishonour. I'm really proud of you. And thirdly, we're going to be talking about the travesty that is Oh My Vlog.
Yeah, this magazine that came out about vlogging, even though, you know, digital, analog, they're not really, you know.
I mean, young girls are we'll talk about it on the actual
podcast. There's a magazine about vlogging. You know, some woman from the Indie wrote a crazy piece about it, the details of which we will be going into shortly. But all of that is to come after the break.
The break is a 10-second sting, Jimmy.
It's a break.
Okay, make a cup of tea or something during the music playing right now. Continuing our obsession with leadership contests and internal elections, the Conservative Party have now announced their four candidates for London Mayor. They are, everybody knows who these guys are, Stephen Greenhale.
Greenhalsh is how that's pronounced.
I don't care. Syed Kamal and Andrew Boff. Oh, and some guy called Zach Goldsmith. If you're not reading between the lines, all of these are kind of not national figures apart from Zach Goldsmith.
So I mean, we run a political podcast and we've only heard of one of these people.
Yeah, yeah. So we do this for fun and don't know who any of these people are. They are pulled, obviously Zach Goldsmith is an MP, and the rest of them are pulled from the London Assembly, members of European Parliament, and like a deputy mayor for crime and policing. Controversially, perhaps, two very high-profile figures who are on the national stage who had declared that they wanted to run for mayor. Sol Campbell, the England footballer, and the very high-profile individual Ivan Masso, who has been running a very good social media campaign and turning up on my Facebook feed, have not been included on the Conservative shortlist. And I'm calling this as basically the Conservatives paving the way for Zach Goldsmith to be a better-looking Boris Johnson. John, what do you think?
Sol Campbell is a bit of an idiot, for one. Because so he wants to run for London Mayor. Okay, I mean, I think that's idiotic to begin with, personally. Because what's he going to do? Sort of set London up in a sort of 5-5-2 situation or something?
To be fair, he has been very vocal about political issues.
What political issues has he been vocal about then? Apart from racism, which...
So he's been vocal about racism. Right, no, he's been vocal about funding to projects that help people come get out of poverty. He's said that he's been somebody who grew up...
which, as we know, so all of what you've just said are clearly conservative issues. He's definitely with the right party.
So something. I wouldn't write off Sol Campbell. I think that as an individual, apart from being one of the only people stupid enough to move from Tottenham Hotspur to Arsenal, he is quite a likeable figure, and also shows a diverse face to the Conservative Party. And for God's sake, they desperately need that diverse face. And also, we're forgetting that the London mayoral election gives an individual the second largest mandate in any election in Europe, behind the French presidential elections.
That's technically all going to change, though, isn't it, with the sort of devolution that's now coming into play with different cities?
Yeah, but right now.
Okay, right, yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, but by the time... Well, potentially by the time that this goes through, Manchester will have more powers. Cornwall will also have more powers. So, I mean, there was even Boris Johnson calling for more powers for London a couple of weeks back because he wants it to be kept up with Manchester.
Bristol's going to have more powers, apparently, soon.
Everyone
well.
Gets more powers.
Everyone's getting more powers, and it's wonderful.
Because George Osborne said, didn't he, if you want sort of more powers for your city, write to me.
I'm gonna do that for my flat in Stratford. Yo, can I be mayor of my flat? That would be great. And then the second person who was conspicuously left off of the shortlist was Ivan Masso, who is he's a billionaire, made an awful lot of money in finance, and is now in like this weird kind of lifestyle where he's a gay man who has a 20-year-old boyfriend who's living with a lesbian who is carrying his child. And so he's like got a lot of common ground with the average London voter.
Well, you say Sol Campbell's diverse, but isn't that
I mean, that's like hyper diverse. But these two, I feel like these two candidates who made a lot of noise when they first announced that they wanted to run, they're very conspicuous by their absence off of this Conservative shortlist. This is clearly deliberate, right? They want an establishment figure. Zach Goldsmith is going to continue the legacy of Boris Johnson. He's the only person who, in polling, has been able to come even close to the Labour favourite Tessa Jowell. Is this the Conservatives just doing kind of like their backroom dealing and making sure that their favourable candidate comes through?
I think if that's the case, it's a really bad move, because London has generally swung Labour, which sort of goes towards...
Boris has won two elections, and he is like a personality.
Yeah, but like,
that's how he's won.
Boris's big thing is that he manages to get Labour voters to vote Conservative. That
it's
is like
because he's so bumbly and
yeah,
cute.
Well, it's amazing sort of personality management, because there's no way he's that much of it. Like, nobody trips up on a stage like he manages to trip up on a stage, or has their hair fucked up within 5 seconds.
Controversial statement here. John thinks that Boris Johnson deliberately trips. You heard it here first.
I definitely does. But I think it's not going to play into their hands to get behind Zach Goldsmith, because if anything, Londoners would be more likely to go for a Sol Campbell type figure, somebody who was, you know, represented sort of ethnic diversity and something a bit more progressive, because at the moment that's what's kind of...
And everybody loves a footballer. Look at David Beckham.
Well, yeah, exactly.
Do you think that this is basically the Conservatives shooting themselves in the foot, Jimmy?
Not necessarily, because... I guess there's two ways you can look at it. I think it's interesting that you said Zach Goldsmith is quite close to Boris Johnson, and the person who's expected to take over from David Cameron when he resigns as Prime Minister in a couple of years' time before the next general election is George Osborne, who sees Boris Johnson as a rival. So I think it's quite interesting that Zach Goldsmith has been put forward in that sense, but also it probably says something about the confidence in the Tory party at the moment that they're willing to put forward someone who's basically just a standard Thatcherite, really. Just, you know, socially liberal, economically liberal. They're obviously feeling pretty good about themselves at the moment.
Clearly, but then why even bother having this... Like, it's a tokenistic shortlist, right? The fact that this is a high-profile platform to run on means that you have to be a high-profile individual. Boris Johnson has proved that. And Tessa Jowell is the person to beat, and she's very difficult to beat because she's incredibly popular in the capital. Do you think that they are going to have a chance to topple somebody who is as popular as Tessa Jowell, John, with somebody with such a limited scope of the shortlist that they've put forward?
No, I wouldn't say so. I think in general, over the past few years, the only reason the Tories have held is because of Boris Johnson. I would be amazed if it doesn't. I think Labour could kind of put up anybody at this point. Because if you lose Boris Johnson, I think you lose basically your ability in London, as from their Tory perspective. I think anyway, because he's got. It's all about personality with him. And I definitely think.
But Zach Goldsmith has something going for him that not a lot of the others do, in that he's quite hot. Like, he's got dimples in his chin. He's got a really good bone structure.
But like you were pointing out earlier, he's quite privileged, and that doesn't go down very well.
They're all bloody privileged. All of these guys are privileged.
This is what was amazing about Boris, is although Boris is incredibly privileged, he comes off as a complete idiot, sort of.
The posh thing, doesn't he? He doesn't really come off as a man of the street. He, you know, has that kind of plumbing accent.
But he does, from the point of view, he comes across as this kind of guy who is like accidentally born with a silver spoon in his mouth.
And accidentally. Where did that come from?
I don't really know what to do with this. I've got all this money. It's bloody marvellous, isn't it?
I think one thing Boris does do well is he plays up to that slightly common sense sort of conservatism, which actually carries more with working class Labour voters, I think, than when you compare it to the Islington intellectual wing of the Labour Party, or, you know.
I didn't realise that the Islington intellectual wing of the Labour Party was a thing.
Well, you know, the way Labour's sort of divided is into your people who used to work down the mines, and then people like Ed Miliband who grew up in Islington and were the son of an academic. That's, you know, obviously that's extremes, but that's kind of how people's divvy up who ends up joining the Labour Party, if you see what I mean.
So if you were Sol Campbell or Ivan Masso, how would you deal with this now? Because actually, I don't. What happens now? Can they run as a Conservative candidate, or do they have to run as an independent?
We really should know this.
We should have done more research. I mean, so this is breaking news, so we have no idea. And there's been no, responses from those two particular candidates. But I feel like this has basically exited them from the competition.
I don't see how either of them could run without the backing of the Tory party, because they need all the resources and they need all the connections.
I mean, both of them are pretty bloody rich, so yeah. They might be fine.
I'm not sure they're that rich, but you know, I could be wrong.
Cool. Well, if you have any opinions on this particular story, do you think that Zach Goldsmith has basically been anointed the next Conservative candidate for London with this ridiculous shortlist? If you were Sol Campbell or Ivan Masso, how would you deal with this snub? Tell us on Twitter at Right Dishonour. Where else can they find us, Jimmy?
RightDishonourable.com and YouTube.com/RightDishonourable.
And stuff will be on YouTube at some point, maybe.
When Jazza gets around to it.
Yeah.
So somehow, the businessman Donald Trump has 28% support in the contest to win the Republican candidacy of the next US presidential election.
Mm-hmm.
This is ahead of Jeb Bush, who was the guy who was supposed to be winning at this point, but currently has 14%.
The guy who's supposed to be winning.
He was supposed to be winning, you know. keeping in line with, you know, the Right Dishonourable's habit of correctly predicting who will win leadership elections.
Yeah.
Although we were right about Farron, so, you know, that's cool.
Yeah.
Anyway, so somehow Trump has actually managed to get this incredible amount of support, and now it's looking like he's going to derail the entire contest into farce.
It's going to be so much fun.
Yeah, it's actually even better than Bush versus Clinton, isn't it?
Oh yeah, 100%.
But this week he came out and said,
oh my god, yeah, I hadn't thought about, if he wins this nomination, some of the debates that are going to go on,
That is be it'd be oh it'd be beautiful.
It'll be television gold. Oh, it's gonna be great. God. It'll be even worse than Palin because Palin was being reeled in from being a loco. Yeah.
Oh.
So we should say he said two crazy things in the last 2 weeks. The first thing he said was that all Mexican and Latino migrants are rapists and thieves and murderers, except some of them who, quote, I'm sure are good people.
So nice of him. And
this week he dismissed John McCain, who's a previous US presidential candidate, who fought in the Vietnam War. He dismissed him as not a war hero because he was captured.
Yeah, because he was captured and was a prisoner of war and was tortured and didn't give up any information until he knew that all of his all of the people under him were being set free. He's a legit, like, whether or not you agree with John McCain on any policy, he is a legitimate war hero. Like, he can't put his arms above his shoulders, otherwise he'll die because of the torture that they did to him. Like, he's a legitimate war hero, and Donald Trump has kind of, like, shat all over that.
So, that happened, you know, that was a thing.
In the interview in which he said all these controversial things about the Latino section of American society as well, was the same interview in which he said he was going to win that section of society, wasn't it?
He
said, I'm going to win the Latino vote. By the way, I think they're all just dirty immigrants.
So a major problem that the Republicans are going to have in the future is that America is becoming increasingly Latino. Mm-hmm. I think there's about 70% white people in the US at the moment, but over the course of the next couple of decades, that's going to swing and it's going to be more and more Latino. Therefore, the Republican Party has a huge demographic problem, basically. Mm-hmm. It has to start appealing to these people.
Which is interesting because they actually have two Cuban-American people running for president at the moment, Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio. This is another thing about the Republican selection process this year, or in this election cycle. It's ridiculous. There are like 14, 15, 16 people running for president, to the point where when they have come to debate, they've had Fox News, who is hosting the first debate on the 6th of August, has decided to say, okay, we're going to take national polls and we're going to take the top 10, which is going to cut out like nearly half of the rest of the people who are running for president. And the problem is, at this point in presidential elections, the national polls don't bear any representation to who ends up going through to the final stage.
So, do you not think that Trump actually has a chance of being the Republican candidate, given that you don't believe the polls?
It's not that I don't believe the polls, it's that the polls shift.
Right.
So, an example is somebody called Rick Santorum, who ended up coming second to Mitt Romney in 2012, but started off with like 0.1% of the national vote this time in 2011. And the fact that Fox News has so much power in terms of, oh yeah, we're just going to take 10 and we're going to do it on national polling, which doesn't show how far people are going to go through the election process traditionally, is kind of a bit crazy.
But how else could they do it? Because having 15 candidates in a debate is just unmanageable.
So if I were Fox News,
okay.
Surprisingly, Jimmy, I've let my ego run wild on this. And if I were running the whole Democratic selection process, I would have a ballot and I would have them randomly selected into two debates. So I would have like favourites and people who are nobodies kind of like spread over two debates. And then you'd have like six or seven people on each of the debate stages, and it's not based on who is the most popular one. And you can have like more of a, like, obviously the one with Trump on it is going to be a crazy debate regardless.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But you're going to have like more of an even spread in terms of who is able to talk with who.
Has it been proven that the people they're inviting are actually the sort of top pollers? Or is
is how they're doing.
They're taking an average of the last five national polls.
Okay, so not just like a top 10 of who's paying Rupert Murdoch.
Yeah,
no.
Although I'm sure that does have something to do with it.
Definitely.
So this has also really adjusted the way that Republican nominees have been campaigning. So for example, Chris Christie, who in 2012 was like a favourite to run against Obama, ended up not doing so. He's really unpopular and is probably not going to get onto the debate stage in the next week or so. He has been buying ads on Fox News.
Right.
So this is an amazing thing for Fox News. Oh my God, the American political system might be shit. Oh shit, newsflash. What's also really interesting though is the fact that Donald Trump There have been whispers that he's not going to run as a Republican because he's refused to directly answer that question as to whether he's going to run as a Republican or an independent. And the last time that that happened was in 1992 with Ross Perot.
Ross Perot.
Who ended up with like 18, like nearly 90% of the vote and basically won that election for Clinton by splitting the right of America, basically.
So, but if Trump is getting 28%, at this point, I know you say the polls could shift, yeah, but why wouldn't he run on the Republican ticket if that, you know, was a legitimate option for
him? If the Republican Party decide to sabotage him or kick him out. Basically, because they want Jeb Bush to win. The anointed person who they want to be the next contender for the presidency is Jeb Bush. Jeb Bush is being hammered by Donald Trump in the polls. Mm. And what's really quite horrifying is that Donald Trump is doing all of these gaffes, insulting war heroes and veterans in general, insulting a huge swath of the electorate in terms of like Mexican and immigrants, seems to think that illegal immigration is Mexico sending people to the US, and decides that the best thing to do is like, we're going to build a really big wall. I love it when Republicans talk about building a wall.
So, John, what do you kind of make of all of this? Do you actually think that... do you think Trump is actually a valid candidate? Do you think he could make it onto the Republican ticket?
Well, onto the Republican ticket, definitely, because it's... I mean, that party's a joke. I mean, there
is... So to all of the Republicans who listen to the Right Dishonourable...
I don't think that's a significant proportion of the audience.
You'd be surprised. You'd be surprised.
They're voting for a man who has a bleached fox on his head. And you know,
people do vote for Boris Johnson here, so...
Oh, but no, but this is in a whole different league. Like, the only reason Donald Trump wants to build a wall at the border is so that he can have his name on it and, you know, have all his companies building the fucking wall.
So, a lot of people from the Huffington Post have actually dismissed Trump's, electoral bid as kind of marketing.
Oh, my God, it's hilarious. So I love that whoever decided this at the HuffPo was an absolute fucking genius. They have decided to cover Donald Trump's presidential run, fine, they have to, it's news, but they've decided to cover it in entertainment and not in politics. And I'm like, you're beautiful, beautiful human beings. Like, other news networks have decided to cover it and like blank out Trump's face, and so MSNBC did that for a while and then realized, oh holy shit, this man is actually running for president. Help.
I mean,
help.
Will Huffington, the Huffington Post, be able to continue to do that if, you know, Trump continues to do well in the polls and, you know, potentially even makes it onto the Republican ticket? Will they, you know, continue to do it as entertainment?
I hope so. I really hope so. But so I feel a similar way to Donald Trump as I do, as I did about the potential of Sarah Palin running in 2012. And I was like, I kind of want to see them win just to see the world go to shit afterwards. I just think it will be really entertaining. And just the kind of gaffes that he is doing, like, constantly is quite ridiculous because his polls are continue to be really, really strong and outshine the rest of the Republican thing.
I think it makes a lot of sense that people don't want to vote for Jeb Bush because in the words of George Bush, fool me once, fool me... You get fooled, you can't get fooled again.
So whoever like gets this, whether it is Trump or probably Bush, it will probably be one of those two.
Yeah.
Do we think that they actually have a chance against Clinton, who, you know, odds on is going to be the Democratic
candidate?
No, she's not a sure thing.
What's his name? Bernie Sanders. Yeah, hashtag feel the burn.
He has like...
It's a terrible hashtag.
He has unprecedented numbers of people turning up to, you know, events that he's doing. Go on.
So he's not going to win, and I'll tell you why.
Right.
Because traditionally, the Hispanic and African-American uh-huh. voters will vote for not the insurgent, who in this case is Bernie Sanders, but right. the establishment figure. In 2008, that changed because Barack Obama was incredibly popular with those demographics, mm-hmm. and so he snatched that away from Clinton. At the moment, Bernie Sanders only has support from white middle class.
So Sanders is like, not, well, by America's standards, a hardcore socialist. He's almost like a sort of Corbyn figure.
Yeah.
Jeremy Corbyn being the hard left guy in the Labour leadership election at the moment. But Whereas Clinton is far more centrist, far more, you know, I will tell you what you want to hear because I want to win this election.
So unless something drastically changes in terms of the demographics who are supporting Bernie Sanders, Clinton will have that. I just want to see the bafflement on her face when she has to go up in three debates against Donald Trump. I think that's going to be hilarious.
Oh, God. But, well, because she is such a well-oiled machine. She will...
Oh, my God! You're giving me a horrible
poll. No, but I mean, she's... Because apparently she's going to be the oldest presidential candidate as well or something, isn't she?
If she gets in and serves for two terms, I think by the time she leaves, she'll be the oldest president or the second oldest behind Reagan that there's ever been in the US. I mean, do we think if Trump gets nominated on the Republican ticket, then that's it for the Republicans in this presidential election?
I mean, he's not really somebody who's going to reach across the aisle, or even like reach around his own end of the aisle.
But could even Jeb Bush reach across the aisle?
Yeah, I feel like Jeb Bush is like a reasonably socially liberal candidate. Like, he's the sensible choice.
But the Bush brand is. In some ways is not great, certainly on the left. I'm not sure how the centre...
His whole thing is, I'm a Bush, but not a Bush sort of thing.
But do people believe
he's
that?
He's running as Jeb! Exclamation.
Yeah,
mark.
Yes, very deliberately.
Isn't Hillary running as Hillary? And then
a
some,
big thing that Jeb did as well is Jeb went on The Tonight Show with Jimmy Fallon, which traditionally... like the Tonight Show is traditionally quite democratic and rips Republicans. And has definitely in the past ripped Bushes. So that was like a big upset. In the sense that like it was very sort of, it was a big statement.
So do we have anything else to say about this?
God help us.
All right, well, if you have any thoughts on the US presidential election, particularly on the craziness that is Donald Trump, then please, you know, leave us some comments, give us some stars on iTunes if you're listening through there.
More stars, please.
More stars, please.
Yeah, and if you're supporting Jeb, like Donald Trump, and you think he's an all right guy, first of all, what's wrong with you? Second of all, let us know, and we will happily talk to you, and it'll be fun.
And feel free to abuse John for what he said about Trump. You know, we don't support that sort of, you know, behaviour.
Although he does look like he has a bleached fox on his head. I think that was an accurate statement.
Okay, so this week, a new magazine came out called Oh My Vlog. And
it's an amazing pun.
As implied by the amazing pun of the title, it is a magazine about vlogging. Mm-hmm. So vlogging, you know, something that was created by the digital revolution, only available online, is now being covered in the Dead Tree Press. And we haven't actually looked at the magazine. We intended to, but Jazza was lazy and couldn't be bothered to buy it. So we've just looked at images on the internet, and which... is appropriate. And Jazza, what do you make of the fact that there is now a dedicated magazine, you know, in the Dead Tree Press for vlogging?
So, full disclosure, I'm also one of the like co-founders and contributors to 1080, which is like a mainly digital kind of resource for like vlogging and talking about vlogging and like the YouTube community and stuff like that. So if you are interested in those things, consume 1080's content rather than Oh My Vlog.
But beware, he might be biased in everything that he says now.
Hugely and disgustingly biased. But Oh My Vlog is very much, you can tell just by looking at the design of it, it's smash hits for vlogging. No, like it's Smash Hits magazine for vlogging. If anybody remembers that, first of all, you're really fucking old. second of all, let it go. It's fine. Like, it's just a load of airheady stuff, and teenage girls want to spend their parents' money on everything and anything to do with Joe Sugg and Zoella Sugg.
Isn't YouTube's main demographic like teenage girls now? At least on the vlogging side of things.
On the vlogging side of things, that's the stereotype, right? And so this is very much pandering towards them and trying to get more money out of those particular people. Although I am aware that the vloggers who are on the front page, they're all under the same management. They're all with Gleam Futures. They're all like the flagship vloggers. So they include Zoe Sugg, her brother Alfie Days, Louise Penland, Sprinkle of Glitter, and all of these guys. Very much, they have the same demographics, and they have the same kind of. What, this is the makeup that I have. Watch me prank my roommate. kind of things.
So, John, do you think this is actually proof that YouTube is now being taken sort of semi-seriously, even if the magazine isn't itself that serious?
I think YouTube for quite a while has been taken seriously. Actually, in academic circles, you can now cite YouTube vlogs in essays, which is, you know, it might seem like a sort of facile thing to say, but that's actually quite important. When, on a cultural level, you start sort of being relevant in an academic sense, I think you've got a massive, significant cultural impact. I'm sort of with Jazz on this. The whole idea of like a smash hits for vlogging just seems so stupid to me.
I actually don't think it's stupid. I think that it's somebody's trying to make some money out of this,
right.
And I do know that the people who are on the front cover of this and that people are like using the images of, they didn't know about this.
Right.
This isn't like a venture for them. This is a private publishing company who has decided to capitalize on a thing.
Okay.
And it's like, it's fine. Like, the teenage girls are gonna either be really into One Direction or watch Zoella put makeup on and say that it's normal to have 5 makeup brushes. Apparently it's not. I don't know.
Isn't it a weird thing from a publishing point of view, because say you compare it to the music industry press, a lot of people think that the music press has died in this country, at least, because you can access music far more easily than you used to be able to. It used to be the only places you could listen to music was if you bought the record, if you went to a gig, and now you can listen to music anywhere, anytime, just by streaming it. And doesn't the same argument kind of apply to vlogging?
So I think I'm having an epiphany, like, right now.
Okay.
Zoe's book became the fastest-selling debut novel of anyone ever. Right, she has, and whatever you think about it being ghostwritten, whatever you think about the quality of that book,
it was also bad. I haven't read it.
The money that has been made for Penguin by that book has meant that they are able to pump funds into other books, and it's kind of revitalized the publishing industry. They have realized that these people have automatic audiences who are interested in buying things that they make, and it's like a traditional medium. Books being kind of injected by the popularity of the new medium, which is vlogging. And I feel like this is very much the same thing. For years and years, stuff like Smash Hits told you what you should be interested in. You should be interested in the fact that Ant and Dec have the same eyebrows, or that Kat Deely went on a date with a racing driver, or something like that. But these are people and subjects that a demographic is already interested in, and they're jumping on the back of that. Rather than the other way around.
You're seeing it more as a tastemaker's kind of magazine, in the same way that DJs used to sort of dictate what records people used to listen to.
I think it's the opposite. I think it's them jumping on the fact that, oh my god, these people have millions and millions of people following them. Let's capitalise on it. It's not offering anything new. It's a load of collated photos of people like Tyler Oakley and Miranda Sings, and stuff pulled from information in their blogs. But it's just another fun thing for I keep on saying teenage girls, but some teenage boys, I'm sure, enjoy Zoe Sung's blogs as well. it's them kind of being able to enjoy that culture in another way.
John, do you kind of agree with that analysis?
I kind of think publishing in general, whether it's across magazines or books, surprisingly hasn't changed in the past few hundred years, in the sense that what is so, for example, novels nowadays don't actually sell a lot. Like, I do an MA in writing. I get taught by some pretty important, in terms of like critically, some pretty important writers. In terms of book sales, they haven't got anything. Like, one of my tutors is a guy called David Van, and he wrote a book about his father committing suicide. It's an amazing book, I can attest to that, and like, it's had some amazing critical write-ups.
Brown-nosing a bit.
It's even like on the curriculum in France. Like, it is an important book, but it's sold nearly no copies. Whereas something like 50 Shades of Grey has smashed records. The publishing industry now has come to a point where it reflects what is always true. So now there's a sort of knowledge in publishing that whether your book sells or not, or whether your magazine sells or not, the content really isn't important. What's important is whether you have 5 stars on Amazon or whether people are tweeting about you. So that's like, from that point of view, this magazine will probably be a hit.
In terms of sales.
In terms of sales, because it's talking about something that's really popular.
So, in a way, people have gone from sneering at YouTube and saying, oh, this is, you know, really frivolous and it doesn't matter, and now it is the cultural leader. It sort of defines what is
So this is one of the main issues that I have with it, is the fact that it's, again, mainstream media is obsessed with this corner of YouTube, and this corner of YouTube that, oh my god, happened to all have the same management. And that frustrates me, because there are so many incredibly popular vloggers and incredibly talented video makers on the internet who have huge audiences who are being completely ignored in favour of the Gleam crew. So there's people like Tom Scar, who has the ASDF clips, which are now being turned into a movie, which are genius. He's a fucking genius. And there's people like Bertie Gilbert, who is now a filmmaker. People like PJ Liguori, who is a groundbreaking filmmaker. And they get completely ignored by mainstream press in favour of putting Zoe Sarg on Great British Bake Off.
Isn't it true, generally, though, that culture tends to go for lowest common denominator when it in terms of popular stuff?
Yeah, but have you seen Tom Scar's stuff? It is lowest common denominator. It's like a turtle walking around and then exploding. So, but it's also incredibly intelligent and nuanced. Yeah, but it's just silly.
If it's intelligent, it's not lowest common denominator, is it?
But I feel like stuff like Tom's content can be seen as very nuanced and funny in that kind of sense. But also, anyone can find it funny. Anyone can find a cow going moo and then exploding funny. But then
I sort of see it like in the same vein as South Park's type of audience, in that it's very sort of juvenile. I don't mean that in a bad way, but and I actually don't feel that, even though it's very simple humour in a way. It doesn't appeal to everyone.
I think so. In my experience, Tom Scar is really popular amongst fairly well-educated people who use it as like a 5-minute escape from the boring things that they're doing with their day. So it's an amazing thing to, like, at uni, Tom Scar was so popular because everybody's writing essays, and who doesn't want to see a turtle blow up?
Yeah.
Like, do you know what I mean? It's that, and it really feeds into that kind of sort of demographic of people.
And that's what I find frustrating as, like, a vlogger who has my own little niche on the internet, is that people in the mainstream, parents, journalists who have columns and stuff, think vlogger and think, oh, you have a book out? Oh, you do makeup tutorials? You do prank videos? Like, there's a very specific part of the genre that they think about. Whereas there is so much variety in this wonderful medium that I am lucky enough to be
part of. The bit they focus on is the popular bit, isn't it? It is the bit that
No, it's not the only popular bit. Tom Scar gets as many, if not more, views than Zoe does.
So what do you put it down? Why do you think they focus on Zoe?
Because she has really good management. And that makes it easy, because journalists, yes, Jimmy, I'm looking at you, journalists are lazy as fuck and would rather have a press release land on their lap than go and look for amazing...
I'm not commenting on that.
I'd be a bit more cynical than that. I'd say it's much...
I wasn't cynical enough.
Oh, yeah, well, yeah. I think it's much easier to sell magazines about somebody like Zoella, who's, you know... It's simple to write about, isn't it? She does stuff about makeup and brushes. Whereas if you have somebody with an equal number of followers or whatever who's doing quite sort of socio-political commentary, stuff like that, you don't really want to get into it in an article. It's much easier to just sell magazines or sell articles on the basis of, look at this person doing, you know, what is quite simple, versus somebody who's like a political commentator.
So basically, Jimmy, you need to stop writing about politics and you need to start writing about... stop writing about politics and start writing about Zoella, essentially.
I'll think about it.
I think that's what the takeaway of this segment is.
There's one last thing I want to get on before we wrap up this segment. There was a response to this magazine emerging.
Oh, yeah.
An article from somebody in The Independent whose name I've completely forgotten, in classic Right Dishonourable Professionalism. But the gist of the article was that she was very angry about Oh My Vlog, because it was predominantly white people that were featured.
It was all white people. There's not a person of colour in that magazine at all.
And she said that this was reinforcing the stereotype that... that only white people could vlog, and she said actually there's loads of really talented non-white people who do amazing stuff with vlogs, which I'm sure is true.
Again, though, this feeds into the point that I was trying to talk about, right? So there are some amazing, like, I'm very interested in mental health. There are some amazing blogs out there by people who suffer on a daily basis for things like schizophrenia or whatever. You can watch them all day long. They're really informative, really interesting. But nobody wants somebody who looks like they're dosed up on Prozac versus somebody who spends 3 hours in front of a mirror before they go in front of a webcam. And it's a really horrible, cynical truth about media in general, is people get behind the attractive, simple thing.
Meow.
John's not better at all. Not better. But yeah, I mean, do you, to go back to the race point, do you think that's a problem in the way that YouTube is covered, or, you know, the internet in general is covered, maybe?
Yes, hugely. And as one of the organisers of Summer in the City, I'm particularly in charge of panels. Last year we got absolutely slated, and rightly so, because we only had like 3 or 4 non-white people on any of our panels or performing. And the thing is, it's just really difficult because they occupy a completely different space to the demographic that we are used to dealing with. There were a lot of black and Asian makeup gurus, for example. There's a big community of kind of like East Asian vloggers in the UK as well, and of South Asian vloggers too, who occupy their own spaces. The thing is, they just don't get popular because we are in a society, or they don't get as popular as their white equivalents because we live in a society that is full of white faces. And unfortunately, when you have grown up in that society and then you are told to democratically, in quotation marks, go and look for content that you like, you're going to look for white faces. There are hugely popular like BAME vloggers in the UK. So people like Sully Breaks, who's a spoken word poet, people like Patricia Bright, who's like one of the biggest like Nigerian British vloggers, who does mainly makeup and stuff. People like Jamal Edwards, who started SBTV and like discovered Ed Sheeran. Yeah. Like there's loads of really, really massive names out there. But I think that the issue is that mainstream media, when it wants to kind of cover these things, goes to something incredibly easy because of the facile very simple stuff that they've come to associate with vlogging. And it's easier to talk about somebody who is like a white face and comes from a middle class family. There's also, in vlogging, there's this kind of falsity and like this fallacy of there being, it's democratic and anybody can pick up a webcam and vlog. I'm sorry, you're wrong, because everybody nowadays vlogs with a DSLR. Everybody needs to be able to afford a laptop, needs to be able to afford editing equipment, needs to be able to afford lighting. Who are able to do that? People who are middle class and have more time on their hands and are able to do it for free for a certain amount of time. Those generally aren't people from working class, black, minority, ethnic backgrounds.
Do we think the media actually has a responsibility to represent non-mainstream groups?
Yes. Because actually this came up really interestingly this week with there was a whole controversy over the MTV VMAs where Nicki Minaj was snubbed from a best video award. And people like Taylor Swift and Ed Sheeran were sort of nominated. Nicki Minaj took to Twitter to essentially call this out as racism and say, you know, when black women make a sort of revolutionary video, it's much harder, to get noticed for it. They don't get the credit that they get. And there's a bit of a misunderstanding between her and Taylor Swift over what she was saying. But eventually, Taylor Swift sort of understood what she was saying and said, actually, I agree. Like, this is
And we had a similar thing in the UK with Ed Sheeran being named the most powerful, in quotation marks, the most powerful black and urban artist in the UK by Radio 1 Extra. Black and urban artist, he's a ginger man who grew up in, like, Surrey.
Yeah.
There's nothing black or urban about him.
No.
Although is incredibly influential in that space. But what does that say about, like, the media and their ability to kind of, like, champion black culture and black music and black...
I mean, maybe... the people who compiled that list actually just did it on who is the most influential. Maybe it was the white people who were more influential.
But it was called power. It was the most powerful, and I think that's what kind of made everybody lose their shit.
No, well, I think it's ridiculous to talk about powerful people in the media. Most people in the media have influence rather than power.
You should write a stern letter to Radio 1 Extra.
But there's no excuse for him being on that list, because it was black and urban music as the category. He plays guitar music.
He does rap.
He has lots of grime influences. He is influenced by that culture.
I do take that he is influenced by that culture, but mainly he uses guitar music and he has a looping pedal, which is traditionally a female equivalent of him, whether you like to admit it or not, is Katie Tunstall. She actually does a lot of the same things in her act.
I haven't thought about her in like 4 years.
I know, but exactly. Nobody would ever associate her with black and urban music. It is a bit of a joke that Jason Mraz is another person, like in America, and we finally come to like accept him as an acoustic artist. It kicked off in the same way people associated him with hip hop, which was bizarre.
Okay. I think we should also probably point out that we're all white men.
Yeah.
And so we're talking about this from a very specific point
Jazza,
of view.
You know, they wouldn't have known that, you know, just from listening to us.
No,
or looking at the website.
I feel like we need to clarify that, and we could be getting things wrong because we have a specific perspective.
No, the right dishonourable is always right, hence the name.
And also dishonourable, hence the name.
Anyway, on that note, I'm sure people listening to this have... Well, I'm sure you have your own thoughts about racism in the music industry and racism in the press in general.
This started talking about a vlogging magazine.
Yeah, but you know, whatever. I'm sure you'll edit it and make it beautiful. So anyway, if you have your own thoughts, put them in the comments. Give us a rating on iTunes if you enjoyed the podcast, and even if you didn't, give us a rating as well. We can be found on rightdishonourable.com. We're on Twitter at rightdishonour, and we're also on YouTube /rightdishonourable. I think I've got everything.
I think so too.
Okay, I've been Jimmy.
I've been Jazza.
I've been John.
That's the end of the cast.
Toodaloo. Yet again, we have something that John has said in the podcast that we cannot use. What the hell? It's like offensive comment bingo. What will he say next?